And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and today from Recovery Centers of America, Chief Clinical Officer, Dr. Denny Carice. And welcome.
Thank you, Laura.
Let's get started today. We're going to be talking about the opioid and heroin epidemic that is just everywhere we look today, affecting every family, I think, at this point. But before we begin, let's get started with who are you and what is Recovery Centers of America?
Great. Thank you. So I'm Denny Carice. I am Chief Clinical Officer at Recovery Centers of America. I've been in the substance abuse treatment policy and research field for over 30 years. Also a person in long-term recovery over 30 years. And Recovery Centers of America is a startup company. We started about 2.5, 3 years ago and raised funding to open up treatment centers between Boston and Washington, D.C. to start with. And we've so far opened a number of large residential and multi-site studies that, multi-site systems that have detox, residential, outpatient, inpatient, intensive outpatient, meetings for families and things like that. We've opened these up in Mays Landing, New Jersey. We've opened them in outside of Boston. We have two in Earlville, Maryland. And in a couple more weeks, we're going to open up in Devon. We've also opened up a large outpatient program that I'm very proud of in Delaware.
Hmm. And I mentioned this before the show began today. Does addiction follow trends? Because today this discussion is about opioids and then heroin. But 20 years ago, it was crack cocaine. Is this something that goes in cycles? And is this epidemic different from the ones before?
Right. So we don't see trends where every 10 or 20 years the drug resurfaces or comes back. There are certainly trends that are much more tied to either the availability or the marketing or some other piece of what the drug is about. So there's no doubt that we are in a very heavy opioid use problem with our country. And opioids include prescription drugs and heroin. In fact, the issue really started with prescription drugs. So the U.S. represents about 4.6% of the world's population, but we consume 80% of the world's opiates. And in 2013, 207 million prescriptions were written for opioids. That's enough for every adult male and female in our country to have their own bottle of pills. So as a result of a lot of things that have been going on, the overdose death rate has quadrupled. It's the leading cause of death among people under the age of 50, and it is a very widespread problem.
When we talk about the users, the people who are affected by this right now, is it changing who is using or who is falling into addiction?
Well, there is a big change. It used to be in the 80s, 70s, 80s, and into the 90s. When you saw someone that had a heroin use problem, they typically had what we call a very long drug use career. The trajectory from being what we also call drug naive, meaning not knowing much about drugs, to transitioning over to heroin was typically a 10, 15, 20-year transition period from drug naive to heroin. What we're seeing today is completely unprecedented. We're seeing kids that have never used a drug really try an opiate at a pill party or something like that, start using opiates, prescription opiates, and then within 6 months are transitioning over to heroin. Every day in this country, 600 people try heroin for the first time. And 75% of people who are abusing heroin say they started with prescription drugs. At the same time, about 95% of people in treatment for heroin problems say, I switched over to heroin because it was cheaper and easier to get than the prescription drugs.
Are we older, too?
Well, this epidemic is not hitting the older folks. So as a country, yeah, we're certainly aging, but this is not something that's hitting just an older group. In fact, it's really disproportionately hitting a younger group. So while the national average of people who have addiction problems is about 8.6%, 21.2 million people, the percentage of people 18 to 25 is double that, or 16%. So we are really hitting the younger population.
But are we seeing people of is it a wider age group, though, that you're treating today than in the past?
I would say it's a wider age group because of the younger group. You know, it used to be that, and the average age in the country for years has been about 35, 38 years old, male or female, in terms of who comes into treatment. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing now is a much heavier look at the young adult population. So I would say to you that probably 70% of people coming into my treatment programs today are young adults that are abusing opiates and heroin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've asked this before when this topic has been discussed on the show. Is there such a thing as a functioning addict, someone who is abusing or has fallen into this and is still functioning?
Well, I think a lot of people who have an addiction problem function initially. There's functioning alcoholics, functioning folks with substance use disorders. And I think that what we tend to see by the time people get into treatment is they're not quite functioning anymore. And that's what's sent them into treatment. They're having problems with their job, their spouse, or other things. The problem with even imagining that there's a functioning heroin user is that, you know, even a functioning heroin user can die very quickly from an overdose.
Why do they die? How do they die? Why are we hearing about so many overdoses?
Right. So I'll tell you first how they die. So what happens is that heroin and other opiates, they decrease the respiratory system and the autonomic nervous system. They decrease your breathing to a point where you simply stop breathing. So that is literally why. We're seeing so many more right now because so many more people are using opiates, which are a deadly drug, but also because the drugs, I mean, heroin is a difficult enough drug, but it was a little while ago we started seeing the heroin was being cut with fentanyl, which is an analog opiate of morphine, of heroin. And so whereas heroin is a very potent drug, fentanyl is anywhere from 50 to 100 times stronger. And what we saw happening was that people who were dealing in heroin would cut their heroin with some fentanyl. And in fact, they did it sometimes purposely for somebody to OD. And this may sound very odd, but it's absolutely true that in the brain of somebody addicted to heroin is very different than the brain of somebody who is not, right? And so while a lot of our listeners might not relate to this, what happens when people use heroin, let's say somebody gets a Blue Devil, they have the stamp on the bag, they're all branded, and they overdose and they die. The natural result of that is people that use heroin will go, oh my God, that's really good stuff, I need to get that. And I know that's the antithesis of what the average person might think, which would be something more like, oh, my God, stay away from that. That's dangerous. But that's what's happening, and they're doing that. If you add to that the additional problem that there's so many more analogs of opiates coming online. So where you have morphine or heroin, now you have fentanyl, which is 50 to 100 times stronger. Now we have carfentanil, which is 100,000 times stronger than heroin.
Why is there a fentanyl and a carfentanil to begin with? Was it invented for some other use? Was it devised by the drug industry as a painkiller, as another just form of opiate? Why is it here?
This may surprise you. So there is fentanyl. Fentanyl is an anesthesiology drug. It is a kind of a, you know, last resort pain drug for acute bone cancer type of pain. And it was created for that. The only thing that carfentanil is sanctioned for use for is putting down massive African elephants. That is actually what it was made for. It was made to immobilize these elephants that are, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds. And in fact, one of the problems with carfentanil is that we've had some criminal justice folks that have gone in and done a bust and gotten like one or two grains of carfentanil on their finger and overdosed. That's how strong it is. It's gotten to a point where, at least in Ohio, they stopped people from bagging up the drug and send in special kind of hazmat teams.
I've heard rumors about this, and in fact, it's been in the papers lately that they're trying to back away from that for fear of Good Samaritans not helping.
It's very true. It's you know, you always want to help as a Good Samaritan. You want to try and help somebody, but you don't want to be anywhere near the powder because it really could be deadly, even if you just touch it.
So, why the shift from opioids into heroin? What is it? Because the opioids are so darned expensive?
Yeah, it's a good question, Laura. So, the opioids became a specific problem as a result of the push of prescription opiates. There was a very big push of trainers out in the country that were training docs that these are not addictive, these are abuse deterrent formulas, and so we just really flooded the market with OxyContin and other drugs like that. What happens after after that. And this is really how quickly it happens. The number one place a teenager gets drugs is from their parents' medicine chest. They all go in, they take a handful of pills. It's usually Valium, Xanax, Oxycontin, hydrocodone. They throw them in a big bowl and they have a pill party and they take little handfuls of pills and then they like the feeling of it. And then they start doing more of the opiate. And then they seek out opiates on their own. They say, I got hurt in basketball practice or whatever. And it's a pretty quick addiction, you know, to if you use a certain amount for a short period of time. And then what happens is it's tougher and tougher to get the prescriptions. Right now, OxyContin sells for about $1 a milligram on the streets. So a 60 milligram, OxyContin would be $60. And you find out pretty quickly that you can get the same high on $5 or $10 of heroin. And by the way, it's now easier to get.
You mentioned marketing of heroin a moment ago and Blue Devil. And how does this word of mouth and the new names and what's out there? Doing an advertisement.
Yeah, right, for right. It, yeah. But, I'm not going to do that, right? Yeah. But we used to get the U.S. used to get the majority of our opiates from Colombia, the majority of our heroin, I'm sorry, from Colombia. Now 90% of it comes from Mexico. It was actually this incredible confluence of things that happened, but there was a group in a small town in Mexico that sent young men up here that were really impoverished, whose families were terribly impoverished in Mexico, sent them up here. They didn't use the drug. They got paid a salary, which is unheard of, and they really transformed drug dealing within the heroin trade here, and they became really essentially a Domino's Pizza type place so that they would come to you, they would meet you in the parking lot here, you didn't have to go to the bad neighborhoods, and they would come and they would sell them. They held them in little balloons, $10 bag balloons, and they held a bunch of them in their mouth, and then literally people would come, put their hand out, they'd pop a couple into their hand of these balloons, and they'd meet you wherever you wanted. It really was a delivery service unlike anything we've ever had. What happened was that the police rarely prosecuted until we really saw that this was an ongoing and large thing, because the amounts they held onto were so small and because they would just deport them. And that went on for quite a while until police realized and put out some massive sting operations that there were these kids from this place in Mexico coming up that were all over the country.
So how does the heroin get manufactured on the local level now? How does it get named, and how is it moved from one small group that knows about one to where it's, I've got to have this one?
Right. It's, you know, it really is just word of mouth on the street. A lot of the heroin is shipped up here either as black tar, or it might already be a little bit more refined. And then people who buy the heroin put it into little bags and whatnot. I have to say, I'm a Philadelphia resident, so I'm sorry to say this, but Delaware gets the majority of their heroin in Philadelphia in the West Kensington area. There was one gentleman not too long ago was arrested for, he had 50,000 dose bags of heroin, and they arrested him with this. They found out he was getting that amount about weekly. And initially they said, this is the largest Delaware arrest for heroin in prepackaged bags. So he was buying it on the street in that, prepackaged look. But when they tested the drug, they actually found out it was fentanyl. So the good side of that is, how many lives do we save by taking those 50,000 doses of fentanyl off the street?
Can we legislate or arrest away this? We're now hearing various state legislatures around the country saying, well, two strikes and you don't get a third. You don't get a third resuscitation. You don't get a third treatment. Arrest them. Put them in jail. Is this something that can be legislated or arrested away?
You know, it really can't be. And if it could have been, we would have fixed that by now. You know, if that was possible, we'd have done it, because we've focused a lot on that. The reason for that is, this is a disease. A 50% of your vulnerability to becoming someone with a substance use disorder is the diagnostic term. 50% of it is heritability. About 50% of your chances are heritability. The other 50% is behavior, environment, actions, and whatnot. This is a chronic, ongoing disease, just like diabetes, hypertension, or asthma. Once you find that you have it, it's your job to take care of it, and you can do that. But it's not something that we can arrest or jail ourselves out of.
You know, this is Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and we're talking to Dr. Denny Carice, Ph.D., Chief Clinical Officer with Recovery Centers of America. If you'd like to reach out to her organization, it's easy, 24/7. You can call them at 1-800-RECOVERY. That's 1-800-RECOVERY, and someone picks up the phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I just mentioned that legislators who are suggesting, well, you know, you get treatment the first two times, the third time, you're out. Is this a common occurrence for someone to overdose multiple times before they either just die or finally seek treatment? I mean, what's the course of this when someone finally does end up getting help?
Right. So one of the things that people have to be aware of is that the overdose reversal drug, Narcan, This is a treatment for an overdose. It's not a treatment for a substance use disorder. It's a treatment for the overdose right then and there. And if you don't tie that to ongoing treatment for the drug or alcohol problem, you will see them again, overdosing again and needing the Narcan again. So I think it's a life-saving drug. I think it's great. But again, it doesn't treat the addiction. It treats the overdose. Once you get somebody and you bring them back, that's really an incredibly good time to offer them treatment, to say, hey, you know, we just brought you back. They will be highly motivated, more than they were the day before, at least, you know, to get into treatment. And then we can put somebody in treatment and look at, do you need detox? You know, does this person need to detox safely? If they've overdosed, they probably do have some level of dependency, and then transition them into residential care for a short while, and then into intensive outpatient that might be 3 hours a day, three times a week, onto outpatient. And that's one of the things that I think is really great about RCA, is that it's really a neighborhood model. Most of our sites are, we have detox, we have residential, we have outpatient, we have family services, we have free family support groups, we have AA and NA groups running on the sites. So people can come to us with any level, you know, of need and really stick with it, because there's a lot of breakpoints. Like when you fly somebody out to California or Florida, there's all these breakpoints along the way for them to stop treatment or to stop focus on their recovery. And that's one of the things you want to minimize.
So being close to home can be actually the help.
Being close to home is actually a very good idea. I mean, there was an argument for a long time, you have to get them out of their neighborhood. But the reality is, for most people, that is not the way to go, because most people cannot afford to relocate their family, quit their job, get a new job. If you're going to stay where you live, at least in that area, the best thing to do is start developing your social supports, the people you have fun with when you're sober, people who are sober like you, getting your treatment, being able to go back, even if it's once a month for a while, because we all know that the longer somebody's in treatment, the better they do.
I hate to do it, but let's break it down and say someone does. And I know that it's like homelessness. You know, are you ready to come in off the street? Are you ready to break this cycle? And sometimes it's once, twice, and then maybe the third time it sticks. Is that the same way with deciding to seek treatment?
Well, it is the same way. It's not often time that the first treatment works. The reality is that the more treatment you get is better. So there's this kind of opinion in the field sometimes that, well, you know, he's been here three times, four times, we can't help. If the truth is your site can't help them because they have other needs, absolutely, you are obligated to send them somewhere else that can help them. But the reality is, the fourth time they come, they're more likely to get sober than the third time or the second time or whatever. So having people come into treatment and you know, no matter how many treatments they had before, is very important. Here's another thing. There was a set of studies that surprised me the most in my career. I'm a clinical psychologist, but I did about 18 years doing NIH research. And there was a set of studies that came out that showed that people who are coerced into treatment, either by the criminal justice system or because they were a doctor, a pilot, a nurse that were going to lose their license, or for adolescents, something we call the mommy mandate, if they're mandated into treatment, everybody says, oh, they have to be ready. They have to want help. That's our job. Get them in. People mandated into treatment do as well or often better than people who come in of their own accord. And that was one of the most surprising sets of studies to me. And it was just a great thing to see. And the reality is, That's right, because that's our job. Get them in. And we have certain groups and workshops that are specifically focused on developing internal motivation instead of external motivation. That's our job. Get them to see that you can live a sober, clean, happy life and really enjoy it.
So let's go to that, breaking it down then, step by step. So you are mandated, the wife, the husband, mom, dad, maybe it's a caring boss has deposited you in front of, you know, dropped off on the steps, and you are going to go through whatever process you need to do. What's the intake? How do you do this?
Yeah. So what you want to do is a really comprehensive intake. You want to get information from the family or loved ones if you can. You want to do a medical assessment, a nursing assessment. You want to assess their drug use, and then you want to take a look at all of those variables to decide whether they need residential treatment where they live, where they're going to treatment, or can they be successful in outpatient treatment. A lot of folks need detox first, so that you want to put them in a 24-hour, you know, residential detox for 3, 4, 5, sometimes 7 days. They get group therapy, they get yoga, they get doctor visits, they get case management, they get all kinds of different therapies. And then after their head clears a little bit, they can move on into a traditional residential program. It's funny because a lot of our treatment programs, RCA in particular, they're really lovely. They're in beautiful places. They've got beautiful sheets. They've got beautiful pillows and great food. But the reality is there's hard work going on every day. It's not a vacation. You are in groups and different seminars and workshops from like 8 a.m. until 9 p.m., including 12-step activities, AA, NA, but also including all different kinds of groups around motivation and around relapse prevention and things like that. And then ideally, somebody would transition from that residential place into an outpatient where they would go back, maybe even go back to work, and they would have treatment maybe 3 hours, 3 times a week. They'd come in and do a group and a seminar, see somebody individually once a week, and then transition down to twice a week, then transition down to once a week. If we know that a minimum duration of treatment across those modalities of care would be 90 days. It takes 90 days to change a habit in general, let alone a habit so tied with your brain circuity. So 90 days for sure. But ideally, if you can keep somebody in treatment, just connected, even if it's once a month for a year, you've really increased the chances that they're going to be able to do this on their own.
What about methadone?
Yeah. So methadone is a medication that's used when somebody is simply not able, not ready to stop having the opiates in their system. Methadone is a medication that can be used to keep them at a very steady state of the opiate in their system. We don't know yet what happens with cocaine in the brain in terms of long-term changes, and we're not, you know, who's to say that heroin doesn't change the brain structure, and that there aren't some people who have that need to be filled for quite a while. Ideally for me, I love to see people go on and to become not tied down to the methadone, because you have to show up almost every day at the methadone clinic. There's other options now too, like Suboxone, which is a film that you can take that's got a little less structure around it, and that a lot of people seem to do very well when they can't get completely off of the opiate on maybe 2 milligrams of Suboxone for a while. And if somebody can be helped that way while they meet other people who are living their lives without being chained down to heroin and other drugs, they can learn to do that as well, and eventually they may be able to get off, maybe not.
If someone is hearing this, when's the time to pick up the phone and call for help? Whether recovery, whether, you know, calling a number, when is it time, and what do you hear when you dial the phone?
Yeah, if you're out there and you're using drugs and you are unhappy with how that is affecting your life, that is, it makes you miss social engagements, it makes you miss work, it makes you disappoint your family, you have medical problems related to it, you're constantly getting in trouble. You don't have to be all the way down kind of in the gutter to call for help. You can call any time and just say, hey, I think I might have a problem. You can go in and meet with somebody one-on-one and just talk about whether you have a problem. You don't have to, it's not like you check into rehab or not. There's all different levels of care. If you're somebody who loves someone that you think has a problem, the first thing I would say to you is please ask them, talk to them about it. Sometimes people say, well, if I ask them if they're using and they're not, they're going to get angry at me. What if they are and you don't ask?
And so it can be a family member. It could be a coworker just looking for information is to find out how to approach the person and talk to them too.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually more common that a family member calls, to be honest. So family members, and a lot of times it's a family member calling for somebody, a son, a spouse that's been in and out of treatment and had problems off and on. But sometimes it's a family member calling and saying, how would I know if my kid is using? You know, what would I look for? What are the signs to look for? And we have a lot of that information too on our website. You know, what if I think my kid's using? What if I know my kid's using? You know, how do I approach my spouse? You know, what's treatment like? What's a day in the life of someone in treatment like? All kinds of information around that.
And another big fear is treatment covered by insurance and Medicare? And what if you don't have insurance, et cetera? We've all heard the horror stories that someone is ready, but there's no bed for them.
Right, right. That's a difficulty. You know, there are, you know, the United States has a block grant that funds some folks for treatment that don't have the money and don't even have Medicaid. But that's a limited funding, and there's often long waits for those beds. The good thing about those sites is that typically you can get a long-term treatment. Once you get in, you can stay in for quite a while, whereas insurance, it's very tough to get 3, 4, 5 weeks. There's also some new legislation coming out that's looking at mandating that if a doctor prescribes this treatment, it's got to be covered. It's not up to the insurance company. It's up to the treating doctor. So I look forward and hope that that will be passed more nationally. It's been passed in New Jersey now. But it is difficult. We have people at all of our sites, and their full-time job is to talk to insurance companies and explain to them why this person can't leave treatment yet or when they're ready or whatnot.
Mm. Now, when we go to your website, I went to your website. And do you want to give us, what is your website?
It's 1-800-RECOVERY.com, just like our phone number, but .com.
And so when I saw one of the things, a window came up immediately, and it was 5 ways to help a loved one. And that was just one of the things that I saw on the website. Do you want to give us a quick overview in our waning moments here about what you would find at the website?
Yeah, again, there's who do we treat? What is a treatment day like? How would things be different for if you were a young adult heroin abuser versus an older adult alcohol abuser? There's everything on our website from the symptoms of detox to how to cook healthy in recovery and how to feed your body in a healthful way. There's things on our website around exercise and how that helps people stay into recovery. And then there's links to all different kinds of resources, and there's information on all our different treatment programs.
Is there lots of support? Because you mentioned it's a chronic disease, and like a diabetic, you're not going to tomorrow say, oh, well, now I'm fine.
Right. So it's a chronic disease that you need to manage. But one of the things that I find difficult is that only about 10 to 12% of the people who meet criteria for a substance use disorder ever get treatment on any given year. If only 10 or 12% of people with cancer got treatment, the public would be outraged. And a big part of people not getting treatment has to do with the stigma. You know, if your kid goes in the hospital, they have cancer, somebody, your next door neighbor comes over with a casserole, right? I really look to the day that somebody can be in treatment for substance use disorder and your neighbor comes over with a casserole and says, I know you're going through a tough time, you know, how can I help? One of the things we really need to do is let go of the stigma. People need treatment. Treatment, it can be very effective, and it's just like any other disorder.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, for more information about everything we've talked about today, that was really easy. Go to 1-800-RECOVERY for Recovery Centers of America and online, 1-800-RECOVERY.com. And again, you have locations in, Massachusetts area. You're in New Jersey at Mays Landing, opening in Devon and here in Wilmington as well.
Yes.
Recovery Centers of America, and it's 1-800-RECOVERY or 1-800-RECOVERY.com. And here's where I say thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Laura.
You're welcome back absolutely anytime. My guest today has been Chief Clinical Officer for Recovery Centers of America, Denny Carice, PhD. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.